Now, usually in classrooms, you don't have microphones, and I find it very difficult to speak over a mic. I'm accustomed to walking and preaching as I talk. And I hope I can project my voice at certain intervals when I so deviate from my written notes. I might add, this is the first time I've ever written a lecture in my life, 10 years of teaching. However, I shall limit my discussion, generally speaking, to the geographic area of the North before the Civil War for several reasons. Number one, contrary to popular belief, proselytized by revisionist historians, which scholarship dominates American scholarship in this country, that blacks in the North suffered, which is really the truth, a similar oppression as his black brother did in the South. In the South, slavery was a presumed legal institution. In the North, blacks were presumably free. But as history will bear out, blacks suffered equally in the North under freedom, quote unquote, or more specifically, quasi-freedom, as blacks did in the institution of slavery in the South. Secondly, and most important, that the oppression, the subjection of blacks, relegating them to the lowest stations in life, was not only sanctioned by the church, but it was buttressed, and the church was the bulwark of racism in this country. Okay. Third, that at least in the free states, one would have thought that the churches should have taken and assumed the responsibility charged them by the very nature and tenets of Christianity itself. Okay. Fourth, that racism was institutionalized nationally, and that the church did not maintain the status quo. It shaped and molded public opinion, which was anti-Negro or anti-black in essence. Now this is these kind of four basic statements I've made. They're gonna make a lot of people uncomfortable, but the truth always does. I do have evidence to support everything that I say. Can you hear me? Okay. In 1907, and I could give you quotes subsequent to the date of 1907, John Ambrose Price made the statement, quote, that he who doubts that the Negro was created as a servant to his brethren, doubts the word of God. Price was a minister. Okay, just with this background then. As an element of racist thought, religion was equally important as science, history, or sociology. The concern of the racialists, or more specifically, racists, with the origin of man and his division into races was sufficient in itself to lead them to the Bible and fundamental Christianity. But other important considerations pushed them into the same direction. To be complete and the total subjugation of black folk, an appeal had to be made on all levels of American society, or in all levels of American society. And to most Americans, religion was a vital force, an intimate part of life, okay. A debasing and profane racism was therefore unsatisfactory, or rather incomplete. It had to be supplemented by religious authority, by scriptural proof of racial inequality. Religious racism was, by its very nature, most appealing, not only to the ignorant and uneducated, but also to the, quote, wise and very, quote, educated, unquote. Appealing to the emotional rather than the rational or scientific. It was thus a very valuable component of anti-black thought in this country. Throughout American history, popular notions toward the Negro, or black man, have had biblical and religious justifications. 17th century slaveholders, for example, feared the work of missionaries in their zeal to Christianize blacks. Slave owners argued that Christianization was incompatible with slavery. And at this point, I have to stop walking. Can you hear me? Okay. The general argument, and this goes back to colonial America, ladies and gentlemen, that, let's take, since the Anglo-Saxon, or the British, became the dominant white group in this country, in most of the southern colonies, you can date it back to the end of the 17th century. Leadership coming forth from Great Britain, okay, and the Anglican Church of Great Britain had grappled with this idea of a baptism being equated with freedom. Okay. Now, this is extremely important because Great Britain comes into the whole colonization movement much later than the Spanish and the Portuguese. You know, the Portuguese, after 700 years of exposure with the Moors and the influence and domination of the Catholic Church in Spain and the whole Iberian Peninsula, for that matter, had a history. They had historical precedent through laws and legislation based on not only the nexus between church and state, but the implementation of these principles, sanctioned by the church, and put into political practice through laws dealing with blacks. Daniel Saxon didn't have that. Okay, he didn't have the history, the historical precedent of laws dealing with slavery and the enslavement of black people. He had a system of feudalism, and which is clear, and it's something that I think needs to be researched more fully, that of all the cultural baggage the English brought to America, bringing with them all their traditions of Great Britain into these North American colonies, if you had any system dealing with the bondage of one man over another, it should have been similar to a system of feudalism. Why is it that black people were made chattel, property, durante vita, meaning for life, and were sold as property? There's no historical precedent for that in English history. None, none whatsoever. But very early, the church grappled with this issue and stated very clearly that the baptism nor Christianization of blacks had anything to do with their civil or political status. And the quotation often rendered was, render to Caesar that which belongs to Caesar, and render to God that which belongs to God. No one ever stopped to ask or to state that Caesar belongs to God too. That's what I'm adding. Okay, nobody did that. Nobody said that. Not anything, all the research I've done, they never said Caesar belonged to God. Okay. But this was the distinction made, that the soul then, the soul, the spiritual growth of the black, was the only realm or purview or power of religion and of the churches, and that his physical body became the political part.
of his existence. How idiotic.
Okay. All right. That's how they dealt with that. Okay. And, oh, this is by 1696. In 1701, the Society for the Propagation of Faith in Foreign Parts, that's a long title. I will refer to it as SPG here on in. In Foreign Parts, immediately began to, in England, send sermons over, dictating the limited power of the church in regard to the political status of the black. Okay. Now, with that understanding, your slave owners began to say, well, okay, you can Christianize them. Christianize them. You know, nice civilizing. Okay, which will bring you to something else soon. Okay. Now, back to my own written notes. It was the position of the church then to relieve any anxiety on the part of the slave owners by settling the argument of Christianization of blacks, nor their baptism, change their legal status. Okay. I want to repeat that in another kind of way. Generally speaking, religious authority has been used to buttress discriminatory acts and repressive acts toward the black man. Slavery at first, and later segregation. Okay. Another influence, which is difficult to assess than others, is the historic tendency of religious bodies in this country to neglect the racial problems altogether. Okay. They don't even deal with it. Okay. Like most Americans, church groups find these problems until recently very embarrassing and even distasteful. Okay. But the very lack of their action on this matter of racism in this country in itself is a policy, because it has had the effect of a passive endorsement of the status quo. Okay. The religious phases of anti-black thought in 20th century America derived from pro-slavery arguments traced back to the colonial period in American history, and with few modifications to fit America, or to fit the contemporary America, the arguments have generally remained basically the same. From the writings of Bartholomew de las Casas in the 16th century. Bartholomew de las Casas, the Catholic priest, he sold 13 men, much given to the dedication of Christianizing the heathens of the New World. And I noticed that in most textbooks, the mention of Las Casas there, but they mention him only in reference to a statement that he makes about the noble savage, the Indian. He is noted through history for his condemnation of the enslavement of the Indian, but there is a semicolon in that sentence in which he states that if you have to enslave anyone, enslave the African, not the Indian. And it was with the sanction then of the Catholic Church in the early 16th century that the bishops would sit on the African coast, dominoes obiscum, over the slave ships as they left the African shore, and bless them, bringing chattel slaves to the New World. Okay. Now I can perceive de las Casas in this, in terms of, to me, this is the arrogance of white supremacy. or evidences of it. How a pope can sit in the Vatican and by a papal bull of 1494 or something like that divide the whole world in half, half of it going to the Spanish and the other half going to the Portuguese without asking the indigenous peoples of the areas in which they were going to exploit and quote-unquote Christianize anything. This does not even mention his lack of knowledge of the known world at the given time, but to divide the whole world by religious sanction and papal bulls, okay, between the Spanish and the Portuguese. And subsequent to that papal bull, to show you again the nexus between church and state, the Treaty of Tordesillas was passed, which virtually dictated politically the same thing. Okay. Now, I've mentioned Las Casas, de Las Casas, in the 16th century. Didn't you have the role of the Anglican Church and the society, which I should call the SPG, Society for the Propagation of the Faith, or Gospel in Foreign Parts, which deals mainly with the American colonial period. You can go from there to the antebellum writings of Professor Thomas Dew, Chancellor William Harper, Josiah Priest, George Fitzhugh, for example. They all use biblical and moral justifications for slavery. Wherever such varied post-bellum spokesmen as Hinton Rowan Helfer, and there's a reason why I'm mentioning all of these names, because I didn't get a chance to go to your library today to check out your resources. You know, I understand you have black studies on this campus. I want to see if you do. Okay. And if you have them in your library. Okay. All these men used biblical and moral justifications for slavery, whereas such varied post-bellum, that is after the Civil War, spokesmen as Hinton Rowan Helfer, Atticus Hager, Josiah Strong. I know everybody knows Josiah Strong. I had to read that in high school. Our country, you know, what's going to happen if all the immigrants came? He wrote in the 1880s, you know, about the mongrelization of America. It was infiltrated by the Chinese and blacks and the Japanese and the Italians and Jews. Josiah Strong was strong, okay. They all use similar justifications for policies of repression and discrimination after slavery was legally ended. Okay. Between 1900 and 1930, religious racism persisted. Anti-black theorists and writers continued to exploit Christianity and the Bible, and organized religious bodies still endorsed or failed to condemn racist policies. Long after scientist class and scholars had the idea of racial, of the inherent inferiority of races as held unsound, and long after that was established, the religious, the churches still maintain that concept, okay, even till today, okay. It endured among many, many church groups. This is especially true of your fundamental churches in the South, okay? This fact indicates the powerful impact that the American churches have had in shaping and reflecting popular opinion. Now, I stated earlier that in many cases they supported the status quo, but I am more convinced that the churches created the status quo, the policy, the thought. They didn't support already what was. They created the attitude, the intellectual milieu in which people acted, or upon which people acted, through the pulpit. Okay. It is with this general background in mind that one can begin a discussion of the evolution, the growth, and significance of the black church in America and in American history. Okay. The oldest urban black church was established in Philadelphia by Richard Allen and Absalom Jones. Now, Richard Allen was born a slave in 1760. Belonged to a Mr. Benjamin Chew of Philadelphia. This is Philadelphia now, the city of brotherly love. Okay. The seat of the Continental Congress. You know, the shape foundation, you know, the whole American Democratic Society was shaped right there in Philadelphia. Dig it. Okay. By 1787, Richard Allen had purchased his freedom. In his autobiography, he stated, quote, "Preaching was given out to me at 5 a.m. in the morning at St. George's Church. I preached at different places in the city. I saw a large field open in seeking and instructing my African brethren." Remember this part of it, you know, because now Allen has received his freedom. And he is now dedicated to the freedom and the salvation, and at least the spiritual salvation of blacks. It attests to many kinds of myths I hear perpetrated by black students about the Negro, okay, that the revolution only began in the 50s when they grew up. Okay. The black revolution began, class, when the first black African said, "No, I am not going." It began when the first black African woman jumped ship, killed her babies, and refused to have her children placed in slavery and herself. That the 1950s, or the era in which I have heard even scholars chronologically begin the Negro Revolution, is a gross insult to your black forefathers, and is just historically inaccurate. Okay. That blacks have always had a sense of stewardship to their lesser brothers. And it was the middle class black, those who were least oppressed in this system, who took the initiative and the leadership to aid their black brothers in bondage. If you will note, I have always remembered, you know, I could just go on, you know, this is why I hate to prepare notes. I'm a teacher, not a note reader. I'm always constantly reminded of the words of Richard Allen, David Walker in his appeal, in which he analogized, black, you've always heard blacks don't have any responsibility to other blacks, that this is a new dimension, you know, this is brother, sister, and the dashiki and all that, you know, afro and your dashiki means nothing if your head ain't straight up here, okay. All right. And let me tell you what David Walker said in his appeal to blacks. David Walker was free. He was well off as a contemporary black, free black of the 1830s. He had nothing to lose. But he wrote, published, he traveled a lot in terms of freeing his black brother. And when the whole idea of colonization was in vogue, which did come in vogue in the 30s, you know, I was going to send blacks back to Africa, or send them anywhere but just out of America, you know. David Walker's response was that, "Do not go." That it was the responsibility of the free black in this country to stand at the top. He analogized it to being at the top of a mountain, you know, with a chain, you know. Have you ever seen mountain climbers pull one up? They do it by chains. That the free blacks were almost at the top of that mountain.
and that the chain went all the way down to the bottom. And until the last slave was pulled from that bottom up to the top to freedom, then everybody was a slave. And that the free black was just as oppressed, he didn't have any more freedom than the slave, legally enslaved, black man in the South, none. And that it was the responsibility of all blacks to have some sense of stewardship to their lesser brother. So the concept of stewardship class has been one of the main streams of black history. It didn't begin with you youngsters. It didn't. I'm sorry. It just did. Okay. And I'm not putting you down. You know, you ought to be proud of that. All right. All right. Now back to my notes. All right. Okay. He said, now I'm going back now to Allen, Richard Allen. He said, I saw a large field open in seeking and instructing my African brethren, who had been long forgotten people, and few of them attended public worship. Okay. I raised the society in 1786 for 42 members. We all belonged to St. George's Church. We felt ourselves much cramped. Okay. We established our own prayer meetings and meetings of exhortation. But the elder of the church soon forbid us holding any such meetings. You know, during the antebellum or any the period prior to the Civil War, a meeting of six or seven blacks in some states is held to be criminal. You know, you just don't gather six people, don't gather. And free blacks were anathema to the white man in this country. U.B. Phillips made a statement once, in his book, American Negro Slavery, that American society was built for two groups, whites and slaves. And if the free black man was like the fifth wheel, you know, he didn't have nothing to do with it. He was out of it, you know, and they had to get rid of him. He was the most feared segment of the black community, you know, most feared, okay. And he had every right to fear him because the free black was doing it, okay. And here's Allen, okay. He said, we felt ourselves much cramped. We decided to have our own meetings, and this elder, white of course, forbid us from holding any such meetings, okay. Now I'm quoting Allen now. A member of us usually attended St. George's Church on 4th Street, this is in Philadelphia, okay, again. And when the colored people began to get numerous, dig it, in attending the church, this is always a problem with whites. One nigger is all right, okay. And numerous in attending the church, they moved us from the seats we usually sat on and placed us around the wall. And on Sabbath morning, we went to church and the sexton stood at the door and told us to go to the gallery. That's a euphemism for nigger heaven, which I will mention in a few minutes, okay. He told us to go, and we would see where to sit. We expected to take our seats over the ones formerly occupied by us below, not knowing any better. We took those seats. The meeting had begun, and they were nearly done singing, and just as we were just as we had got to the seats, the elder said, let us pray. Now, I don't know, I am a Catholic, and I had to stop to think about this passage, that in Protestant faith, and it is a similar kind of, when the priest say, let us pray, I mean, you don't be moving all around the church. You know, you can get on your knees and let us pray, and you bow your head. I know this is true in the Catholic Church, and it is obviously even more solemn in the Protestant Church. You don't move about. When the man says, let us pray, that means it's a solemn moment in which you're on your knees. Okay. Let us pray. We had not been long on our knees before I heard a considerable scuffling in church. I mean, the in church part is not him, it's me. In church. Okay. And low talking. He said, I raised my head up
And so one of the trustees, having hold of Reverend Absalom Jones, pulling him up off his knees, asking my man to say, let us pray. Okay. And saying, quote, you must get up. You must not kneel here. Mr. Jones replied, you know, wait till the prayer's over. The trustee replied, no. You get up now. No, this is not, it's funny, but it attests to the tragic humor of our history. Okay. The trustee replied, said, no, you must get up now, or I will call for aid and force you away. Okay. One of Alan's friends now. Mr. Jones said, will you please wait until the prayer is over? He said, we will get up and trouble you no more. Okay. With that, he beckoned. This is Alan now. With that, he beckoned to one of the other trustees to come to his assistance. Okay. He came to a William Whiting, who was in black, another black member, and yanked him off his knees in church. Okay. By this time, the prayer was over. I guess it was. You know, this is me. This is me now. Okay, I guess it was. Prayer was over. And we all went out of the church in a body. And they were no more plagued by us anymore in that church. We had subscribed, here's the tragedy of all this. We had subscribed largely to the building of St. George's Church. We built the gallery, laying the new floors. And just as the house of God was made comfortable, we were turned out from it, turned out from enjoying the comforts of worshiping therein. Okay. Now, in terms of history, in spite of my informal method of presentation, I was trained in historical evidence. This excerpt was taken from the Bishop Richard Allen himself. The Life, Experiences, and Gospel Labors was published by the Philadelphia AME Book Concern, in case you want to check me out. Okay. Richard Allen and Absalom Jones and the group that left the church hired a storeroom and held their worship services there. It was the beginning and rise of the first church of the denomination later known as the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Many blacks in other cities were in similar situations faced by Allen and Jones. In Baltimore also, New York and New Jersey. Okay. In 1816, a general meeting was held by way of a conference. At that conference, it was resolved, quote, that the people of Philadelphia, Baltimore, and various cities should become one body under the name of African Methodist Episcopal Church, quote. It was this pew incident that sparked the origin of the independent Negro church, black church. It must be stated here that in any church or any creed or color, blacks could seek spiritual comfort. But such instances as cited above and the general feeling of being unwanted and the fact of separation convinced many of the doubtful spiritual expressions under such, advantages of any spiritual expressions under such conditions. Would you say, where is God in any kind of situation like that? You know, this attests to, you know, recent scholarship by the same MacPherson, number one, who has done a study on the Negro in the Civil War. He's used widely as a textbook. Well, McPherson should have stayed in Civil War, the Civil War period, you know, and stayed out of church history. I heard him recently do a study at the American Historical Association, this was not this year, last year, in which he stated that blacks wanted their own independent churches, okay? That the black independent churches were started ipso facto of themselves. Black independent churches were started as a reaction against discrimination, segregation, intimidation, oppression, physical violence in the house of God by whites against them. You would want an independent one too, and so would I, after going through all those changes for God. Okay. All right. So that just shoots that, his whole thesis to pieces. Okay. For in truth, the emergence of all black churches, of the all black church, resulted from the unwillingness by black communicants to worship in seats reserved for them in the rear of the church or in the gallery. Most churches had, quote, nigger pews, unquote, to which colored parishioners were confined. Okay. In churches which distributed sacramental bread and wine, such as in the Catholic Church, and I'm a witness to this, blacks had to wait until whites had partaken of communion before they could go forth and get theirs. And as I said, I am a witness. I can remember in the state of Maryland, St. Mary's Catholic Church, Colton Point, Maryland, in which my family took me and my brothers and sisters to a Catholic church predominantly white. Now, this is in the 20th century. Alan is back in the 18th. I'm talking about the 20th, me in the 20th. Okay. In which blacks, me, I did, my brother did, had to sit in the back of the church. And when communion was given, I went strutting up there. Well, I didn't know. My mother with her shaky, nervous self, she yanked me. Don't go up there until after the white people go. You know, and so I looked around. I was a child. But I got over it, but my brother never did. He has never set foot in any church since. And he told her, he was a teenager, I was younger. You know, so I know this for a fact, that blacks did have to. They had specific areas set aside for them, and when communion was given, you went last in the same church of God that talked about man's brotherhood to man. You know, this is what, no, I don't even get on that, about that black power handshake with white people. I don't understand it. All right. Absalom Jones differed with Richard Allen over religious affiliation. You know, remember with Jones and Allen were the two in the church, okay? Jones differed with Allen over religious affiliation. Absalom Jones favored the Anglican tradition, whereas Allen favored staunch Methodism. In terms of principle and doctrine, there's not too much difference. Methodism comes from the method of worship. It means Methodism is more evangelical, it's more emotional, whereas pure Anglicanism is staunch, refined. As a matter of fact, you had during the 18th century, the 1820s, 30s, you had a big movement in the country over the rise of the evangelicals, you know, and Methodism is the result, the resulting factor of splits in the Anglican Church over the method of religion, is thus the term Methodism, okay. As a result of the split, Reverend Absalom Jones organized St. Thomas's Protestant Episcopal Church in 1794, becoming its first pastor, okay. Allen, in return, was ordained by Bishop Francis Asbury, and Reverend Allen's church was dedicated in 1794, which means then that Richard Allen was the first black bishop in this country, okay. It was called the Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church, whose membership was limited to blacks, okay. The black church, contrary to historical scholarship, did not originate out of any desire to separate on their part. Generally speaking, they were forced out of white churches, segregated against, coerced,
discriminated against, refused entrance, physically abused inside churches and out, and the preachers, not only the members, but the preachers too, their only recourse was to be on an independent basis in order to live. If you want to live, not even worship. Their lives were in danger, okay. At the conference held in 1816 in Philadelphia, it was their desire to form a separate branch of Methodism with Allen as the bishop. This was consummated, okay. This new AME church soon became truly national in scope. In less than 10 years, it had extended its operations as far west as Ohio and as far south as Charleston, South Carolina. Now, my own area of expertise in my dissertation deals with the state of South Carolina. And during the 1820s and 30s, when Methodism itself was gaining ascendancy in the South, you know, Virginia and South Carolina were heavily Anglican. As a matter of fact, you can go trace it back to colonial period. It was by law. You had to be by law an Anglican, worshiping the Anglican faith before you could even vote. As a matter of fact, South Carolina political parishes, our political districts are called parishes, you know, from the church, the relationship between church and state, okay. So when Wesley, this is the head of Methodism, when his whole evangelical movement came south, the Anglicans were pretty much disturbed in anti-Methodism in the South, okay, but they began to alter that for several kinds of reasons, which I hope I get a chance to mention, okay. Seeking an escape from the drudgery and disabilities of everyday existence, blacks found spiritual comfort and opportunities for social expression in the church while exercising a powerful political, social, and moral influence. For the black minister was unquestionably the most influential and important figure in the black community. Okay. And if you're black, you know what I mean. Okay. He also contributed some of the most militant leadership to the black man's struggle for equal rights. Such men as Theodore S. Wright, Henry Highland Garnett, Samuel Ward, Charles B. Ray, James W.C. Pennington, Amos Jerry Beeman, and Daniel A. Payne, to mention but a few. The black minister frequently used his position and his prestige and pulpit to arouse his congregation on issues affecting their civil rights as well as their moral rights. Okay. Not only did he condemn the colonization movement of blacks, segregation, and disfranchisement of blacks, but he also persistently attacked the licentious literature, infidelity, and atheism in this country. Okay. Encompassing virtually every aspect of black life, the church provided innumerable services. In addition to being a center of religious devotion and ceremony, it was a school. It was a political meeting hall. And whites knew this too. You know, this is why they didn't want blacks to congregate more than six. You know, that is why, okay. It was a community for recreation. It was a social center, and all too frequently, a haven for fugitive slaves. And whites knew it, but they couldn't prove it, okay. Take one case of probably someone you'd never heard of. His name is Amos Jerry Beeman. He was pastor of New Haven, Connecticut's African Congregational Church, who effectively illustrated the pivotal importance of the antebellum black religious leader and the church as a center of community life. Under his direction, the blacks in New Haven organized benevolent associations. Now, this was very early class in the 19th century I'm talking about. Here again is this concept of stewardship coming to the fore, which needs to be clearly studied and researched. That Your free African societies, beginning at the latter part of the 18th century and early part of the 19th, usually came about as a result of church affiliations or the leadership of some minister. When I say benevolent associations, I mean that blacks, free blacks, took it upon themselves, collectively, communally, you know, I guess they would call it communistically today, to pool their resources to aid the sick, bury the dead, feed the poor, and clothe the children, educate them. They set up schools. You know. The whole concept of burial and a collective entity before you die, of a pool of money before you die, was the precursor of insurance companies, dearie. You know, blacks started that in this country. The whole idea, okay. Refute me, if you will, okay. All right. The benevolent associations then, library clubs, circles of improvement. Okay, it was just not just a sermon or a preaching or going to church talking about St. Paul said this, you know, and not in the black church, it wasn't, okay. And forums. And at the same time, they helped to organize temperance societies, which not only condemned alcoholic beverages, but discussed the slavery issue. See, the nexus between the political and religious. They discussed that, okay. Education, national organization, employment, okay. And the merits of mechanical arts and agriculture as a systematic scheme of education for blacks, vis-a-vis the academic training. You know, this is something that's been going through the black experience. You know, the Booker T versus Du Bois, you know, we've been arguing that one a long time ago, okay. In addition to using the church for these various activities, black children were educated, and they received Sunday school instruction. As an anti-slavery leader, Beeman, Amos Beeman, welcomed fugitive slaves. Okay. He convened abolitionist meetings in his church, helped to organize state and national Negro conventions, campaigned for Negro suffrage, published newspapers all out of his church, and contributed to the various abolitionist journals. Okay. In short, Beeman effectively combined the roles of Sunday orator, politician, and social leader, and that was, in fact, the epitome of the black preacher. Okay. Who's going to be here soon? The country preacher will be here. One, Jesse Jackson. You dig what I'm saying? Okay. Now, documentation on that one. Okay. Robert Warner did a study on Amos Beeman, his life, and it was called The Memoir of a Forgotten Leader. And it was published, and this is something I want to bring out too, by the Journal of Negro History in 1937. And the point I intend to make here is that most of what you're hearing, class, black scholars have written generations ago. You know, and you don't know it. Now, I'm saying that you individually or you collectively. But blacks and whites are so totally unaware that the scholarship has been written and published in journals and books, but it wasn't popular reading. You know, back during the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Now black is a fad, and you have your white scholars, Jews in particular, who have monopolized and taken the whole scholarship dealing with black, putting brand new covers on it, and they're doing nothing but rewriting articles that were published during the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Now my question to you, because I haven't been to the library yet, is do you have every volume of the Journal of Negro History? The Journal of Negro History was begun in 1915. By Carter Woodson. Do you know who Carter Woodson is? Do you? You know, and I'm not fussing with you. You know, but just get it together. Don't tell me you black if you haven't got it together. Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah, this was done a long time ago. The scholarship has been done by black long ago. All right. Do you have the Journal of Negro Education in your library? Every volume. Do you? Do you have all the Crisis volumes? Do you have every volume of the Arno Press?
In your library.
So I can see you all on. Well, that's universal. My students don't go in. They don't go to the library. And it's all sitting over there, been done dusty. You know, that's okay, but I'm gonna go tomorrow. We'll see. All right. 1937, now this is done. All right. 5 black scholar, too, by the way. 1, okay. Okay, through the sermons then, the black minister exerted an immeasurable authority over his flock. The minister, all through American history, molded public opinion and set social standards. The white minister, to the detriment of the black. The black minister, to the advantage of the black. Okay. Segregated, politically proscribed, and economically oppressed, many blacks could find at least some solace and encouragement in the plight of the Israelites under Egyptian rule, or of the early Christians under Roman rule. The minister also encouraged racial pride among his parishioners and hope, telling them about the achievements of their ancestors, abundantly evidenced in the Bible, and telling them also that blacks should not lose hope, for they would conquer the oppressor. See, that's dangerous. And they didn't say in the next world. That surely he, meaning his oppressor, must reap the whirlwind. The ranks of your black militant abolitionists came chiefly from your ministers. The Reverend Henry Highland Garnett, the who you were dealing with today. Okay. Pastor of the Liberty Street, New York, Negro Presbyterian Church, appealed to his enslaved brethren to strike for freedom or perish. Now I'm going to quote you, Gollum. He said this back in the 1840s, okay. He said, if a band of heathen men should attempt to enslave a race of Christians and place their children under the influence of some false religion, surely heaven would frown upon men who would not resist such oppression, even to their death. Now, in those days, that was revolutionary talk. And God, as a matter of fact, Henry Highland Garnett did not fare too well, you know, by white abolitionists, as a matter of fact. You know. Many black ministers and laymen had little use for this other world argument. And questioned, for example, the fervor of a religious instruction, charging that such instruction had obscured certain basic realities. God would not do for blacks what they had to do for themselves. The idea that man had to pray for what he received, one black leader contended, had long been disproved. Had not the experiences demonstrated that man could live on this earth without any semblance of organized religion, as long as he conformed to the physical laws of nature? It is only necessary, he stated, in order to convince black people of their error and palpable mistake about religion, to call to their attention the fact that they are the most religious people in the country, and they are the poorest and the most miserable. Okay, that's Martin Delaney. He said this in a book which he wrote by himself, Condition, Elevation, Immigration, and the Destiny of Colored People, 1852, okay. Now, while Negro Methodists and Episcopalians laid the foundation for an independent Northern church, Baptists also took steps toward a similar separation. In 1809, 13 Philadelphians formed the first African Baptist church. And in that same year, the Reverend Thomas Paul organized independent Baptist churches in Boston and New York. Already active in the South. You know, independent black church is active in the South. Okay. The Black Independent Baptist Church attracted a large northern following and soon vied with the Methodist as the most important and powerful black denomination. The great appeal blacks had to this, or the great appeal that these two denominations had to blacks, was due to the evangelical nature of presentation. It was an appeal to emotionalism. Okay. As Richard Allen stated, the plain and simple gospel best answered the spiritual needs of black people that all the other denominations preached so high-flown that most blacks were unable to comprehend the doctrine. This is true. Allen contended further that he was convinced that the reading of sermons would never prove as beneficial to blacks as spiritual and extemporaneous preaching. Exhortation. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where are my Protestants from the South in here? I know you here. Do you know who the exhorters are? Did you read Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man? Could he exhort? Well, this is what he's talking about. He's not talking about written like I am doing here. And I find it detrimental to me. He's not talking about reading from a Bible, you know. He is talking about the exact manifestation of some spiritual fulfillment and the articulation of that through words. That's exhortation, class, and you don't learn it in any divinity school. Okay, and I'm not putting down the church. I still go. I have a crucifix on. Okay. But I'm just quoting you historical fact. Okay. Oh, by the way, the same appeal, you know, just it wasn't for blacks, that Paul White's also like that evangelical thing, you know. It was more popular. Have you ever heard of the Burned Over District of New York? That's when it really started in upstate New York. Evangelical booze and the Shakers. Do you know what the Shakers are? They went into a frenzy out there in the West. You know, that's it. That evangelical, it appealed to Paul White's. Okay. So it's not a color thing involved ever. Obviously, relieved at the great loss of so many of their black parishioners, white churches continue to reflect and preach the prejudices held by white Americans. In the white society, the church possessed equally as great, a spiritual influence over the people. To preserve, quote, proper decorum, church officials, I knew it, assigned an inconspicuous, no, I'm serious, church officials, I'll start again, to preserve, quote, proper decorum, unquote, church officials assigned an inconspicuous position to their colored brethren, quote, unquote, brethren, quote, unquote. When attending services, blacks found themselves segregated either in what they call African corners, quote, unquote, nigger pews, quote, unquote, seats marked capital B, capital M, meaning black members, or aloft in, quote, unquote, nigger heaven. The quote-unquote nigger pew most dramatically symbolized the Negro's inferior status in the church. Race-conscious Christian whites, generally deeded their pews on condition that no blacks be permitted to purchase them. A Boston black man once acquired a white man's pew in payment of a debt. When he and his family attempted to occupy the pew, a church committee immediately notified him that any attempt to occupy that pew would lead to disastrous consequences, and that he must confine himself to those seats assigned to blacks in the upper gallery. Ignoring this warning, the black man entered on the following Sabbath, found a constable barring his way into the pew, and finally decided not to pressure the issue against such formidable opposition, Mr. Black Man. These incidents are so numerous, ladies and gentlemen, that it almost becomes ho-hum, you know, or redundant for me to constantly repeat them. Suffice it to say that most churches protected themselves against any such pew incidents, or as part of these deeds in pews, by a restriction which confined any transfer to, quote, respectable white persons, unquote. This, in terms of documentation, was taken from the National Anti-Slavery Standard in 1840, okay? With the rising tide of abolitionism during the period of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, the church in their attempts to remove and eradicate disruptive influences took active steps to quiet anti-slavery agitation by black members or black ministers. The position taken by Bishop Benjamin T. Underdonk of the New York Diocese is revealing for several reasons. Peter Williams, the Reverend Peter Williams, a black activist, in 1834, was a minister of St. Philip's Episcopal Church in New York, was asked by Underdonk to publicly resign his position from the American Anti-Slavery Society. As Underdonk explained it, he's the bishop, quote, the church had to avoid such controversial issues and maintain itself on the Christian side of meekness, order, self-sacrifice to the common good and to the peace of the community, unquote. This was taken from Carter G. Woodson's Mind of the Negro. Okay. As I said, and published in 1926 when Woodson did this, you know, Peter Williams said this, you know, was anti-slavery activist in 1834. You know, Carter Woodson did this whole exposure on the Mind of the Negro from 1800 to 1860 in a book published in 1926. Okay. It is with this that I shall conclude my remarks by alluding to a significant date in American church history. That date was 1844. In 1844, the Methodist Church split over the issue of slavery. You know, so many scholars tell you slavery wasn't caused by the Civil War. It was caused by a blundering generation. Slavery wasn't caused by the Civil War. It was caused by the tariff. Slavery wasn't caused by the Civil War. It was caused by a misinterpretation of the Constitution. Slavery wasn't the cause of the Civil War. It was caused by two divergent civilizations. Class, slavery was the only cause of the Civil War. You know, the only one. You know, it's simple. They said it themselves. Read the contemporaries, it's clear what caused it. But scholars, modern scholars today, going back, reinterpreting what, you know, folks have said, number one, it's a moral issue involved, and they can't handle the fact that their brothers in the North and brothers in the South were fighting over an immoral institution, one section trying to maintain an institution which they knew was morally wrong, you know, so they had to put it on something that's not morally involved. They put it on economic determinism, a plundering generation. You can't blame that. You can't touch a blundering generation. You can't touch economic determinism, and you can't touch the tariff to blame. So they had to take it out of the whole moral thing. And these are your Southern revisionists. I could go on about that too, but I won't, because I'm concluding. Wait a minute. All right. Wait a minute. All right. The Methodist Church split over the issue of slavery in 1844. In their annual conference, the issue of clergymen owning slaves was discussed. It appears that a clergyman had married some woman, somebody, she died, and slaves in some states were considered the personal property, consequently passed to her husband, to her husband. And he accepted the slave. And the whole issue was discussed in the annual Methodist conference, okay. When the Northern contingent of the conference held that it was against the religious principles of their faith for any clergyman to maintain slaves, keep slaves. The Southern clergymen maintained that slaves were property and that the institution of slavery was the foundation of their society. They walked out of the conference and formed the Methodist Episcopal Church South. And I don't know, I have been reading, I remember reading 2 or 3 years ago, where they were meeting to unite once again. And perhaps you can tell me if they have. I don't think that they have. Okay. In 1845, over the same issue, the Baptists split over the institution of slavery. Southern clergymen wanted it. It was part of their way of life. The conference said no, and they split. And it became the what? Southern Baptist Convention. Okay. That is also evidence of slavery as the precipitating factor in the Civil War. Anything to the contrary, notwithstanding. Okay. Then again, the Episcopalians and the Presbyterians did not have the severe split. They had to split in 1861 because the war started. You know, the Civil War started. And they passed, they had a conference saying that the religious boundaries or the religious diocese had to follow geographic lines. You know, that was kind of new because it didn't really before. So that meant that they ipso facto really split. However, in reading, in terms of my own dissertation, I read the conference held by the Episcopalians in the South, and they clearly stated that they sanctioned the whole concept in society of the South, dealing with slavery. They sanctioned slavery, the Southern way of life, and that they supported the political stand taken by the Confederacy. Okay, those are your Episcopalians. They immediately after the war, they were united once again. You know, but owing to the war itself, the Episcopalians and Presbyterians were forced to, because of the geographic area in which they decided to split. And it is with that I will close my discussion and open up questions. I hope I haven't talked too long. There's a lot more I could tell you in Black Preacher, taking him back to colonial America, which is important. You know, he was used, attempted to be used as a tool. You know, maybe you have some questions about that. You know, what I don't know, and perhaps you could give me some insight on, and my own personal belief, is that Black slaves never bought that. They didn't buy that. As a matter of fact, they turned that whole religious idea around and justified for revolt. Because it was Gabriel Prosser in 1800, Denmark Vesey in 1822, and Nat Turner in 1831. Every one of them said they had spiritual, they had visions, you know, didn't they? So they turned it around. They didn't buy that, you know, they didn't buy it. You know, but the attempt was on the part of whites to indoctrinate blacks to make them docile. And when plantation owners found out about the positive parts of Christianization, then they said, yeah, Christianizing, you know, keep them quiet. But then the upshot of it was the evolution of the Black church, which became even more militant, you know, against the racism in this country. No one asked me to define my concept of racism. Oh, let me leave you with a quote by Du Bois. Du Bois said a long time ago, he said, instead of America being called land of the free and home of the brave, he said it should be more realistically called the land of the thief and home of the slave. Are there any questions? Anything? Did I talk too fast? Because I do go fast.
We will have a short answer, question and answer period. Following the question and answer period, there will be a reception.